You're listening to podcast number 213, The Further Conversations on Bodily Fluids and Waste Management Techniques with Paul Wheaton and Carol Steinfeld, recorded live in San Francisco. Enjoy.
So we just saw a guy with a dog, and because we're in San Francisco, we're at some, where are we?
Fort Mason.
And we parked, and there's all this green space, and a guy's dog took a dump on the grass, which is dormant. They're not watering it. They're saving water. And he had a little plastic bag, and he picked up the dog's poop.
That's the cop.
So there's a cop out there. We can hear the cop telling the guy, put the dog on the leash or leave Fort Mason. Oh, my. Jeez, for a second there, I thought, like, we'd done something wrong, and the actors were surrounded.
I thought he was correcting you.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm here with Carol Steinfeld, the author of several books on urine stuff and poop stuff and composting toilets and, let's see, Liquid Gold, which is the book that I found out about Carol from. I really enjoy that book. Reusing the Resource, which seems to be a collective of different techniques, like 50 different techniques on managing this resource out of the bottoms of people.
That's great.
And then you also have a book called The Composting Toilet System Book.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw the person reaching down with a little bag to pick up the poop, and you said...
I'm amazed that people are adverse to using a composting toilet or anything like that that involves a little bit more management of excreta, more than they're used to, and then they go out, walk the dog, and quite rightly, as is their local policy, they follow the dog with a plastic bag and pick up that dog poop. That exposure right there, of course, they do have the plastic in between them, but everything that goes on with that dog's paws, everything they bring into the house, dealing with those bags, that is way more exposure to excreta and fecal coliform than most composting toilet system owners have in their day-to-day use and maintenance of their composting toilet system.
So being a responsible dog owner is filthier, far filthier. And I'm using the word filthy to represent pathogens, I think. I always think of pathogens.
The old meaning of filth, that's right, which
Usually
meant slops or something thrown out the window, exactly.
So it's far filthier than being the owner of a composting toilet.
I'm going to stick by that statement. Yeah, not filthier, but again, the same exposure to pathogen than that you would have with owning and using and maintaining a composting toilet. And that's good news because you know dog owner or your friends who are dog owners are not falling over with pathogen-related, or I should say fecal coliform-caused illness. And that's something that should assure anyone considering owning and using a composting toilet.
I think it gives an idea of the safety. And when you're talking about the the dealing with a composting toilet, then it's kind of like, well, it's an extra bit of management above and beyond with a sewage bay system or a septic system where you flush. And so it's kind of like for some people, their composting toilet system is going to involve lugging a 5-gallon bucket somewhere. And so that 5-gallon bucket lug is less, dealing with less per year than dealing with walking a dog in a city.
Oh, that's actually a good parallel or comparison. Yeah. And there are all sorts of composting toilets that can be designed with way less maintenance than lugging a 5-gallon pail. That's probably the easiest
right.
one. That's one you can make today in your garage. But, yeah.
And I think it's the one that's the starting point. It's the... So yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking. Like, so now in this podcast, I've already described the system that I've now described to you earlier today, of Steve Hackeroff's system, which seems to me to have pretty close to zero interaction, and I can't help but think that so far Steve Hackeroff's system is, I'm going to say, 87 billion times cleaner than any sewage system I'm familiar with. And I just made that number up in case people weren't sure.
Is that a scientific number?
I could make up larger numbers. but I think that the key is that with Steve Hecron's system, it's a sealed system. Nothing leaves. Whereas with a sewage system or a septic system, I mean, I remember it was one of Art Ludwig's books where it had an image, and I think it was his water storage book, not his gray water book, his water storage book, where it showed, oh, and here's your septic system in the drain field, and look at all the little black gunk I've drawn coming out of the bottom of that, and here's a dry outhouse, and look at how much stuff coming out of the bottom of that, like none. Because a well-designed outhouse, which effectively is what Steve Hecroth has, is a well-designed outhouse, can be cleaner than septic or sewage. But a poorly designed outhouse is obviously far worse than either of those two. But anyway, am I wandering off the topic? I'm not sure. The topic is how they're cleaner, how they can be cleaner. And I think it's the human interaction with dealing with poop stuff. Is less than dealing with dog stuff.
Here's what I would say. Composting toilets aren't for everyone. There are so many options if you want to design a super efficient on-site wastewater management system. What's great about composting toilets, I see the category that they are part of as being where it's all going, and that is what we call source separation. Just like with solid waste and trash and garbage, we are now keeping the plastic separate, the paper separate, the aluminum foil separate, the food separate, because all of those waste streams can, if they're kept separate, be transformed into a resource. And that's how wastewater will be increasingly seen. So you likely in the future will have the purple pipes, the separate plumbing for gray water. None of that should be going to our wastewater treatment system if that's what you're part of, because they're using a lot of energy to move wastewater through pipes using pumps and then cleaning it with a lot of energy, and then it has to be discharged somewhere. More and more, especially as more people live in cities and closer together, we need to find ways to reduce the cost of living and to create better infrastructure. And one way we can do that, learning from the permaculture community, is looking for ways to use these waste streams so they don't have to be part of the city's wastewater management challenge and expense. So in the future, gray water systems and gray water irrigation will be more mainstream, just as it is in Australia and parts of the U.S. And composting toilets, either a toilet that just flushes to the sewer system or one that's zero discharge on site and, as you say, contained and maintained either by you or even the city's Department of Public Works, those same folks who manage the sewer system, I think that's what we'll see over the next 10 years. And it makes a lot of sense. It adds complexity, but it offers efficiencies and opportunities to turn poop into energy and fertilizer and to use gray water for water and warmth, then you know the story.
I know the story. I'm kind of thinking to myself, but I like the idea that the future, I'm going to activate Mr. Rogers' Land of Make-Believe and pretend something for a moment because he said it was good to do that. And that is that I like to imagine something where we've eliminated the sewage systems, where basically, the poop and pee is managed on site and does not leave. I just keep thinking that it's not that hard, and that there are ways. And it seems like the amount of infrastructure that goes into a sewage system is just huge. And then plus, let's not forget, we're running out of water. Water is becoming more and more of an issue. It's not like we're running out of water. I mean, the oceans have lots. It's just that
it has salt in it, and a lot of energy has to be used to get the salt out. So it makes way more sense to use water for various uses after we've washed with it, after we drink it, as you say. And I think you're right. More and more we will have centralized management of decentralized systems. So all the permaculture funky stuff will actually be kind of formalized and made into systems palatable to mainstream populations. So we will have urinals and maybe urine diverting toilets that keep the nitrogen stream separate, and that can be collected and used for something or used on site. Gray water, of course, will be kept separate. That's an easy one. It does involve more complex plumbing. It involves some complexity of management. Here in California, a lot of people don't like to manage their gray water system. But why should they? Right now, we hire city staff to manage the sewer and wastewater treatment plant. Why don't we have a roaming band of maintenance staff going to your yard and just making sure the connections are right for people who don't want to manage that or don't want to learn how to do that?
You mentioned urinals a moment ago, and I seem to remember something from a few years ago about a urinal for women. You're kind of the expert in that space. Is that sort of thing ever work out, or is it done, or is it going forward?
I'm glad you brought that up. Urinals for women, you just don't see them, do you? And yet they exist here and there. They often require a woman to squat a little or to use it in a way she's not used to. And I just don't see any traction there. There's a woman who made something called the Sheanal, I think it was. She is in Holland, and it's a very lovely urinal, in fact. What women need to know is they could use a man's urinal. You could use this woman's urinal by approaching it backwards. Everything works better, but we're just not used to doing that. You know, introducing a new technology in a public space is always tricky because you have to inform everyone who's using it, using the bathroom, what they're looking at, if there's something different. But more and more, as the cost of water increases and the cost of wastewater management increases, building property owners are going to be incentivized to bring these different technologies, some of them you can't even call new, they're the old technologies, to bathrooms. So we'll see that more and more.
So the amount of water that's being used right now for flushing toilets, I mean, when we're using the older style, which I think are probably still the most common, which are 3 gallons per flush. And I mean, here in San Francisco, there's probably, I think 1.6 is the new standard. And it's less than 1.6.
I believe, and I may have this wrong, everyone should Google this, that by 2013, 1.2-gallon flush toilets will be required to be sold. You can no longer buy a, right now you can't buy a 3-gallon flush toilet a home supply store. So as you say, it's 1.6. But 1.2, which they call the high-efficiency toilet, or HET, H-E-T, you see that around, that's the new standard that California wants you to use. And what everyone should remember is there are two reasons why those sometimes don't work out in a retrofit situation. One is the plumbing that's there is for a 3-gallon flush toilet. You have to make sure that there are slopes and very few bends in your plumbing to ensure that 1.2 gallons can flush to the destination, a septic system, your sewer connection. And two, Americans insist on this arbitrary standard of having the drain line, the drain to the toilet, 12 inches from the wall. In Europe, you'll see that same drain line, and in Australia and in Oceania, like 4 inches from the wall. And that's because they have a gentler curve for their water trap, requiring way less water to push waste. Here, if you go to your bathroom, if you're in an older house, and you'll see a convoluted U, and that was for more of a siphon-oriented, or I'm told, water trap. But that requires a lot of water to move waste around nearly an O, you know, nearly a circle in the line.
All right. So I'm just kind of thinking, like, of all the water that's used in a household, the water for a flush toilet is a lot. And on top of that, it seems like a urinal. There are urinals that use no water at all. So that's a way, that's a path. And then there's other ways to reduce water usage in general throughout the house. And then earlier I was saying something about, like, well, the water doesn't really go away. And what I was getting at with that is that, okay, like, every year you got all those oceans out there, and then constantly the water gets evaporated and turns into clouds, and it comes and makes more fresh water, and so it's this unending constant supply. But we do have problems with the aquifers in certain areas that are being drained. They're like million-year-old aquifers, and people are like getting 90% of their water from the aquifer rather than the water that falls from the sky, and it's like they're starting to run out. In Missoula, we don't have that problem. We have two rivers that join right there, and we've got lots of water. We got just gobs, and so we have a hard time getting too weepy. But we hear these water problems, and it's like hard. I was like, what? Yeah, we have to like actually read a book or something to understand what the hell they're talking about.
It's the same in Massachusetts, 45 inches of rainfall on average. So Massachusetts is supposedly technically a rainforest. So when we're talking about wastewater there, it's usually about how to disappear wastewater.
Right. And so then the thing that I talk about where people have a septic tank system, I say basically the thing that you're doing is when you poop in your septic tank system, so much of that, if you put too much water through the system, you're just like, oh, I'm going to go crazy with the water. I'm going to take long showers and wash my clothes four times more often than you'd be washed, and I'm going to run the sink all the time just for giggles to do the dishes, and water. And then what basically what you do is that when it runs through your system with too much water, you've kind of made poop Kool-Aid, and then you're sending your poop Kool-Aid down into your drinking water where it makes your water taste funny. And so you probably don't want that.
Speaking from experience?
Actually, what I do is I try to put less water down in the system because I'm concerned about that.
You're right. There's less residence time in a septic system if you're putting a lot of water in that tank. And that's another reason to split your flows, get that clean wash water going to someplace else, like a landscape, because it'll actually allow your septic system to do a better job to deactivate, transform pathogens before it's released to the ground.
See, I just kind of wonder about, like, because, like, of all the different kinds of composting toilets out there, and your one book, the Composting Toilet System book, it shows off the buffet of composting toilets. Is that correct?
I would say so.
And how many different composting toilets are there?
Let's say, if I had to count on my fingers, a few bazillion, and that is because there's so many ways.
You have so many fingers.
Yeah. There are many ways to make a composting system, but before people get too hung up on brand names or specific designs or, again, brand names, I would think of a composting toilet system as an aerobic biofilter. For one thing, it's black water only. It's just for the toilet, and you're making it aerobic. You're asking for that same aerobic composting process that's occurring outside in your yard, especially if you have a composter. And instead of the septic one in your septic system, which is mostly anaerobic, a much slower decomposition process. So that's the value of a composting toilet. And one of my favorite designs actually does use water. Why? Because there are too many people who just don't want to look down a poop chute. They don't want any chance to see anything that was deposited there. They want a water trap between them and the poop chute. And my favorite design is one that my co-author designed, and it is a DIY system. There's nothing proprietary about it. It is a microflush toilet, much like the one that's in this RV today, that uses an adjustable flush. It's kind of a direct drop, or we're not asking water to flush poop a long way. So we can use as little as half a cup of water or even just 2 cups of water. And that goes to a composter that you can make out of a rollaway bin or any kind of tankage. We hang a net in it so that we get aeration around the organics, around the excreta that's in there. And liquid goes to the bottom and drains out a line that we have going into a wash water garden. I think my co-author now calls it the eco-cyclet,
but it's a planted system with gravel and perforated pipe. And we vent the composter, so with like a 3-inch line with a fan in it. All of this can be made by you, and the greatest expense is that toilet stool. But I like it because somebody who's adverse to the idea of funky toilets or pit latrines or anything open and offering any possibility of a view of what's in the toilet, they use this and they see a toilet with a pedal flush toilet. You use your foot to flush it, which actually is a great idea, way more hygienic than the flushers we have now. We flush with our hands. And when the composter fills, you disconnect it and put another composter there. Take the first one that's full and put that somewhere warm with a ventilated top and let that compost. And the magic number for your health agent, should your health agent come around, is 2 years, because nearly no pathogen can survive past 2 years. If the biological process and the composter doesn't kill a pathogen, just waiting it out, 2 years containment, just about everything's dead after that. So I think that's where it's all going. It's such an easy composter to make. It uses a little bit of water. You could use gray water in that system. And I'd like to see more installations of those.
So I think one of the topics we've kind of skirted around is the idea of separating urine. And I know that I've always been against it. And in your book, you recommend against, I gotta rephrase this. I'm for separation. Yeah, that separation.
Mm-hmm.
Jenkins says mix it all together, and I don't agree with Jenkins.
I can explain why he said that.
Okay.
He wants you to do that because his system, which is direct outdoor composting, is using a lot of wood chips. He's having you use a lot of sawdust or wood chips after every deposit,
mm-hmm.
As both an odor barrier, but also because with the urine in there, you have a higher nitrogen to carbon ratio than you wanted for the better diet for the microbes that are going to munch everything down to a nice humus. So he's right in that if you're going to combine your urine and poop and add a lot of sawdust, you needed something to up the carbon in that ratio. But poop actually has an ideal carbon to nitrogen ratio for decomposition. It's pretty good. So if you're not worried about also decomposing all that sawdust, you don't really need urine in that system. And he also wants hot composting outside. So he wants your nitrogen to create this super-powered, munching down of everything that creates all this heat.
Right.
But if you're using mesophilic composting, or if you're not worried about hot composting, it's not really necessary. So that's what he recommends is valid, but no need to be absolutist about this. For some other situations, diverting the urine is good. And I like to do it because it's something all of us can do tomorrow. We don't need a special toilet. We don't need a bucket in our bathrooms. We don't need an outdoor composter. You on this RV can do it right now. You can pee into a bottle or pee outside. And urine, as you know, has very low pathogen risk, merely has a pathogen content with some exceptions that usually don't live very long. And it has nearly all, as you know, the nitrogen in excreta. So nearly all the interesting nutrient content of our excreta is in the urine stream alone.
So I once in some, somebody asked me this once, and I was very confident, and then yet the person that was questioning me was also confident, and it was enough to get me to go look it up, and they were basically saying, we started exploring the whole idea of like how urine is nearly sterile. It's like really, really, really close. And so then they said, well, what if the person has Hep C? And so I went and I looked it up, and it turns out that like in a hospital, somebody has Hep C, and there's a urine thing happening, like you're going to change their urethra tube thing, you know. Then it's kind of like they don't wear gloves. They're not worried about it. They're not like the concern over getting Hep C from urine is so small that, I mean, getting it from the blood, big. Getting it from the urine, like it's the amount of time that it lives outside of the body is something like 4 seconds. So
yes,
then
exactly.
It's like
it's a very low risk. At the same time, it's, you know, it is a risk. And so if we had a lot of combined urine right now and we were going to pour it all over a potato field and then dig up those potatoes and serve them raw, I probably wouldn't eat that potato, just in case. But you're absolutely right. The disease risk is very, very low. And also, even if a person with hepatitis C produces some urine that we put into a watering can and add a little bit of water and water our apple tree with that, there's been no direct contact with that. And as you say, the critter, the hepatitis C virus, is likely outside of the human host to die right away. Swedes say the longest it usually lives is 1 or 2 days. And actually, it gets out into the open air here, and there's this vast jungle of microbial life happening, and a lot of it wants to eat that virus. And what goes on in the soil also could create this predation. And then there's acid alkaline that might do it in. So that hep C virus wanted to be in your body, but not outside your body.
So I try to use the example of, like, you're out in a pasture, and somebody with hep C pees on the ground. And then another person comes along and they're barefoot, and they a minute later, and they're unaware, and they step in that spot. And my position is that totally safe. I tried to find something. So hep C, you said it up to a couple of days, but it's kind of like, my reading was suggesting like maximum of 7 seconds outside of the host. And so it's kind of like that maybe under just the right conditions, like, oh, we took it out of the host and then we put it into the special incubator and we managed to get it to stay alive for 2 days. But what was the condition to get it to last 2 days? Or was I read something that's crazy?
Again, it almost doesn't matter because you're not talking about the hep C sufferer urinating into a container and then the next person drinking that, or, you know, you had all of this activity in between the one, the disease host and the person who is exposed to it. So you put it on the ground, it hit the ground, it already hit the air, lots of opportunity for something to munch down on those hep C virus. You put it in the ground, it might be very alkaline there, there's all sorts of microbial life there. So between everything that happens, the whole invisible tiny world, the microcosm, a lot of these diseases die off. Again, at the same time, if you said, Carol, let's go to Haiti and eat some of this lettuce that someone from the cholera hospital just poured some urine on directly, I have to admit I would think twice. You know? Why invite problems? And that's why I say a lot of it is about what you do with the urine and the composted poop.
Yeah. So, I guess granted, if I know somebody is, I'm in the same boat. If I know somebody's sickness, in fact, just the idea that somebody's peed on my food, I'm not like going to, and just the idea that they might be, I just don't want to eat some food that somebody's peed on, really. Okay? So let's just leave it at that.
What if it's your pee?
I'm not even keen on my pee. I don't like.
It's a peach tree with beautiful, luscious 2-pound peaches, and you are starving and haven't eaten for 2 days, and you hear that they have poured urine around the roots of this peach tree.
I'm totally fine.
There you go.
I know that that not only are trees magnificent filters in themselves, but I know that they've got like filters times 10 to create the fruit. And so it's like, I've seen some studies where it's like there's some stuff where they put certain kinds of dyes and the dye will be taken up into the wood. I mean, into the cambium layer and stuff like that, but it will not go into the fruit. And so it really kind of shows the kinds of filtering that goes on. So that's really good. But even then, if somebody peed out into a field of carrots and then like a few days later we're eating those carrots, even then, I'm not that concerned. Well, I would be concerned because if you pee on carrots water, if you give them too much nutrient, then they get woolly.
Oh, I know.
It lowers the quality of the carrot. But I'm trying to think of like a root crop that, you know, maybe potatoes. I really do believe that if somebody were to pee on potatoes and then we're harvesting those potatoes 2 days later, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, Yeah, let's think in terms of buffers. So at my house that truly has a 3-gallon flush toilet because it's a rental and we are forbidden to replace it, urine gets collected even by the reluctant boyfriend, and we put it in a container, and I bring it outside and kind of pour it around the fruit trees and the ivy. I put it in my composter, which has way too many pine needles, and there's a buffer. There's a whole, process. There's all sorts of things in between me and that urine before I pick the peach, before I pick the beans in my garden. And yet all of that has been fertilized with the urine.
I'll pee on the peach tree and then 10 seconds later pick a peach and eat it. I'll pee on the peach tree and I'll eat any peach off of that tree at any time after that. I'm totally, totally okay with.
Well, think about making compost with urine. Like, I like to shred paper and put it in the composter to make it a little less interesting to the raccoon that always gets in there. And then now and then there's a little too much paper, and so I put some urine in there to match the carbon in the paper, and everything kind of gets hot and decomposes faster. And when I tell people, oh, I fertilized the green beans with this compost, no one's asking me, oh, what was in that compost? They might actually ask if I put brown stuff in the compost, but so far no one has a problem with that because there's been this whole process in between them and the pea cycling.
So when it comes to brown stuff like poop, then I've got concerns. And then, this kind of leads into the whole thing about separation. Were we already on separation? Well, I think we started with separation. So I'm back to separation, and basically the thing that I've expressed many times, and I've got nothing to back it up, just my own speculation. And my speculation is, first of all, I know that when you mix pee and poop together, you get like 20 times more odor. And I seem to remember something from your book where somebody actually held a ruler up, we put on our lab coats, we pulled out all of our rulers, and we got our smellometer going, or the stinkometer, and it's like it was measured. I think in liquid gold, there was something about how if you mix the two together, there's more odor to a factor of.
I don't know that there's a factor of, but Jan-Olof Dranyert, who is a social, let's call him a social scientist in Sweden, found that the smellometer, which has a more technical name that I do not recall, says, yes, indeed, combine the two, it's a more malodorous product than if you kept the two apart. And part of that is because you have the poop, the excreta, the solids doused in liquid. So you're getting a decomposition process that's far slower than if it were drier.
The poop has critters in it, doesn't it? I mean, you're going to have all kinds of bacteria and microbials, and there's people living in there.
Yeah, if nothing else, there's fecal coliform in there. We all have that in our gut. And if some forms of that and an infectious dose, as in enough of those critters, can make somebody ill. So that's why we want to manage poop at all times, even in a healthy population. Even though we all know that as we started this, discussion. We have exposure to poop all the time, every day, all of us, our own, our dogs, little kids, and we're not dropping off all the time. But it can happen, and happens in hospitals. Certainly if you have a population with cholera or something kind of funky, one of the extreme diseases like that, it will be hiding out in the poop, and we want to take that seriously with either hot, hot, hot composting or hot treatment of some sort, or up to 2 years exactly, yeah. Residence time.
So now the thing that I've speculated is that urine is Purina pathogen chow. So the pathogens are like, they're out there as a poop, they've left the body, and it's like, oh, life out here sucks. I hate it out here. It's so sad. But then if they have urine there, it's like, woohoo, I'm going to reproduce. So I kind of feel like, mixing the two is not a good thing. Like basically you're you're feeding. Now I've got nothing to back it up. I'm speculating, and which I think speculating is like advanced pretending.
Well, it's good to speculate. It's a hypothesis, and I'm going to say there are a lot of bacteria that can happen or not happen. It's already in the poop. That's in the container. And it all depends on what proliferation you're thinking of. But primarily, it's about the odor is about the nitrogen leaving the process as ammonia. I mean, how many times have we come across that job site, a 5-gallon bucket that the construction team is using as their toilet, you know, behind the project, and it brings tears to your eyes. You cannot believe it. And yet, if they had kept the urine out of that, it would not have been as bad. And a lot of that is simply because of the ammonia and just the chemistry of the two combining. I'm not sure it's about bacteria causing odor. So that's something worth one of your listeners researching for. I see a PhD or master's thesis for a University of Montana epidemiology student.